Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me. Thanks to Norm and Doug for organizing this conference. I've been enjoying it quite a bit. A lot of people have contributed to the things that I'm gonna talk about in this talk, although I think if there's any controversial things or any problems, it's most likely Doug who would be responsible.
That's a given.
I know that. I'm gonna talk about three different planetary systems which are interesting for different reasons. I've prepared three transparencies on HD-806/06, seven transparencies on GJ-76, and 15 transparencies on HD-209/458. 'Cause, you know, sometimes in these talks where there's a, "Oh, I'm gonna talk about three things," and it's like almost time, and he's like partially done with the first thing. There is more on HD-209/458, so hopefully I won't run over. HD-209/458, of course, is the transiting planet, which has been extremely interesting because the transit can be resolved to very high accuracy in the light curve, a light curve that's about one part in 10^-4 photometry with HST. The star is a bright star, so interesting radial velocity information can be discerned for the planetary orbit. There's a big problem actually with the HD-209/458 system in that the observed radius, and this depends on the stellar evolution models and so forth, the observed radius of the planet appears to be about 1.3 or 1.4 times the radius of Jupiter. Whereas all of the current modelers, there's four different groups who have sort of state-of-the-art codes, Henyey-type codes that can make evolutionary models for extrasolar planets, they all tend to agree that the radius should be somewhat smaller. Early models of the system indicated a radius should be about 1.4 Jupiter masses, but then in the past few years, it's been realized that those models were unrealistically hot, sort of in the medium deep interior of the planet. My understanding of that is that the early models were insulated from insolation, so they behaved more like they were in isolation. If that sort of clears up the.
Oh, yeah. Do you wanna translate that for all the.
They were just sort of too warm at the atmospheric interior boundary condition. Basically, they were getting too much heat there from the star. That's now agreed on. There's been three hypotheses that have been offered to sort of explain why HD-209/458 is so big, HD-209/458b is so big. The first one is kind of like an it's all good hypothesis, and what Adam Burrows is arguing is that the interpretation of the planetary model needs to not just look at where the one bar pressure isobar is in the planet and say that that's the transit radius, but you need to do a more detailed look at how large the exosphere and the atmosphere is and where the actual transit radius is. If they don't have a core in their models, then their error bar for their size is sort of edging up. The upper part of their error bar is edging up against the lower part of the error bar for the measured radius. They would argue that there is actually the agreement is not as bad as the other groups are finding. Adam Shulman and Tristan Gulot have a hypothesis that HD-209/458b is large because the radiation onto the planetary surface is driving winds, very fierce winds on the surface of the planet, which are then through a sort of ad hoc kind of way, are depositing energy into the interior below about 10 bar-100 bar pressure level, which is providing an energy source for the planet, which is keeping the planet large. A third hypothesis that's due to Doug and Peter and Rosemary Mardling is that HD-209/458b actually has a non-zero orbital eccentricity and is getting tidal heating as a result of tidal circularization. It's basically the same story that's going on with Io and to a lesser extent, Europa in the Jovian system. There's an eccentricity. The eccentricity is continuously allowing for tidal dissipation to occur in the planet, and that energy which is deposited in the planet, as long as it's deposited at a level that can couple to the structure of the whole planet, is keeping the planet large. I like this problem because all three of these hypotheses lead to different observational consequences, which can be tested reasonably well. And one thing to keep in mind is that there can actually be sort of a mixture of these three things going on. So it's not a cut and dried situation where one group is right and the other two are wrong. But if the effect is dominantly explained by one of these hypotheses, then there's different interesting observational consequences. If Adam and Tristan are right, then the most important consequence is that other hot Jupiters like HD29458b should be large. And also, the radius from the planet, the semi-major axis from the planet where circularization is effective, will be larger. So planets with periods of orbit orbital periods of order a week should readily circularize if their hypothesis is correct, because the circularization time depends on the radius of the planet, and larger planets are easier to circularize. Yeah?
If one of these hot Jupiters came in later, like some scattering or something, and then circularization, and had lost its entropy, would they still be large according to these?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that immediately. Is that right?
Yes.
It's okay. It depends on how long you can sustain the eccentricity of.
So if Adam Burrows is right, then the average radius for other hot Jupiters should be somewhat smaller than the current estimate for HD29458b. And also, that would mean that hot Jupiters are unlikely to have solid cores. It's possible that the core was never there, or it would be possible that the core could be dissolved through some process. But it's in order for to get the radius to be correct without invoking some additional heating, you need not to have a core. Cores generally make the planet smaller. And finally, if this tidal heating hypothesis is right, then HD29458b needs to have a second companion. And interestingly, if HD29458b is being forced by a companion, that's sort of a special case. And so other hot Jupiters should be small. And what that means is that all the photometric transit surveys that are going on that are trying to find these planets, they're all looking for HD29458b, which occults about 1.5 to 1.7% of the star's light during the transit. Those Monte Carlo simulations that go into those transit surveys are all a little bit too optimistic, by perhaps a factor of two in terms of the planetary size. And that can be devastating for transit surveys that are up against a magnitude limit, which all of these transit surveys are. So it has a very interesting consequence.
Unless the other hot Jupiters also have companions.
Unless they're being forced, but one would expect that this is a somewhat special case, which is worrisome for the hypothesis. To invoke a special case is worrisome. Now, there's two more transiting planets that seem to be secure. One is Ogle TR56b, which seems to have a radius of about 1.2 Jupiter radii. It's got a planetary period is 29 hours, and so if the Shoemann-Guillot heating is put into that object, it pumps up to 1.7, 1.8 Jovian radii. Yeah.
The orbit of the planet is inclined with respect to the J2 of the star. Isn't this sufficient to get the small eccentricity?
That may work. It's hard to tell what the that's a tough. You can get at that observation by looking at the signature during transit of the radial velocity, because that depends on the orientation of the rotational pole of the star to the rotation of the orbit. But that's uncertain too, like 30 or 40 degrees. So that in theory can be looked at, but that's a very tough observation to make. Yeah.
There are people who have speculated that the core of Jupiter, of our own Jupiter, might have been eroded away, mixed into the outer layers. Would that be enhanced if you had hot Jupiters?
I would assume it would be easier to do that.
So the fact that it doesn't have solid cores now.
I think that the fact that it doesn't have a solid core doesn't immediately mean that Alan Boss is right. He's probably listening on the internet or something. So gotta come down with a real even hand with regards to these different hypotheses for gravitational instability versus core accretion. So just to quickly go into this tidal heating idea, because this is one that can be immediately tested. You know, the basic point is that you have a perturbing planet which is maintaining an eccentricity, and this is, of course, is a gross exaggeration of what the eccentricity actually is. And so the planet's tidal bulge is always pointing towards the star in an equilibrium tidal model, whereas the rotation is basically a pole on the planet is pointing towards the empty focus, and so you get the librational and radial tides, which lead to dissipation of energy in the planet, which lead to a decay of the eccentricity. But if you can keep giving the planet eccentricity from an external source, then you can maintain the heating for a very long time. And for sort of a typical second planet, this heating can be maintained for up to a trillion years.
So how far is the star off of the zero age means?
Star's about thought to be about 5 billion years old. So it's similar to the Sun. It's a little bit more massive than the Sun. It's a G0. So it's a little bit
And the corresponding orbital decay time is what?
The corresponding orbital decay time is of order many, many billions of years if you have the second planet. Okay, so there's plenty of energy in the orbital energy of the two planets to tap for this process to go on. And you've got as long as you want. So the rate of tidal dissipation in a simple equilibrium tidal model is in proportion to the square of the eccentricity, and the circularization timescale coming from the Goldreich and Soder article is for HD 29458b of order 100 million years. So the fact that the star is about 5 billion years old and the nominal tidal circularization timescale for a reasonable value of Q, for a Q of order of a million, the tidal quality factor of order of a million, indicates that 29458b should be circular. Okay, so if there's an eccentricity, which is presumably a measurable quantity, that's a very interesting observation. So that's the question. The question is does HD 29458b have an eccentricity? Can we already measure that? If not, what do we have to do to get at the eccentricity? I should point out that sort of a way to jumpstart getting a handle on the eccentricity is if you can see the secondary eclipse. CERTIF should be able to see the secondary eclipse of this planet. You can time when the secondary eclipse happens according to, in comparison to the primary eclipse, and then compare that to the orbital period. You can get a minimum estimate for the eccentricity. There is, of course, if the planet's periastron is pointed along your line of sight, that method doesn't give you the eccentricity. It's important to keep that in mind. But CERTIF or Spitzer should give us an estimate of the eccentricity that's completely independent of what I'm going to be talking about here. So here's the radial velocity data for HD 29458 prior to the last season of observations. And what I've done is I've gone through and taken out all the radial velocities that were taken while the planet was passing in front of the star. A big chunk of the radial velocity data set was devoted to looking to this problem of whether or not you have alignment of the stellar rotation axis with the planetary orbital plane. And so there was a lot of radial velocities taken during transit. Those have to be excised from the radial velocity data set. And surprisingly, up until last year, it was a very skimpy radial velocity data set. And I think the reason for this was because they knew they had this one. Once the transit was discovered, they knew that planet was there. So it was given a slightly lower priority in comparison to other, you know, very interesting stars. And so radial velocities were accumulating at a rather slow rate. And there were 30 radial velocities as of last year. And so what I've done here is I've just done two fits. One fit assumes zero eccentricity. The other fit assumes an eccentricity of 0.03. And you can see that they both go through the data pretty well. So before I give any chi-squared blah, 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 I mean, it's pretty obvious that these both fit that skimpy data set fairly well. So when you make an orbital model, assuming there's one planet in the HD 29458 system, you have four free parameters, which comes from the fact that you know the period already very accurately from timing successive transits. This transit was observed actually in the Hipparchus database. If you go to that plot curve macro for the Hipparchus data set, type in the, I think it's 108 something is the Hipparchus number for HD 29458, and you put in this period, you'll see that there's 5 points in the transit interval. So you can see the transit in the Hipparchus database, and that allows you to get a very long time baseline to match up with the accurate ASHT observations and further ground-based observations to get a very nice determination of the planetary period. You can also, for the same reason, measure the time of central transit to quite a high accuracy. And so knowing these two means you don't have to fit for these two parameters. Those are fixed. And so if you just get a best Levenberg-Marquardt fit to the pre-2003-4 pre-last season's velocities, you come up with a nominal value of an eccentricity of 0.03, a pomega, that is the argument of periastron, of 67 degrees, and a mass of 0.68 Jupiter masses. So the question is can you believe that? Before I answer that question, before I try to look at that question, it's for this title, dissipation hypothesis, you want to ask, you know, okay, if you have an eccentricity of 0.03, clearly the eccentricity is not 0.2. If you have an eccentricity of 0.03, is that enough to keep the planet large? Is it worth even having a look at this, or is that just not going to do the trick? So Peter Bodenheimer runs his code for all sorts of different possibilities. And so in particular, he takes the mass of the planet and he looks at whether it has a core, he puts a core in, or he doesn't put in a core, and he specifies two different luminosities, two different tidal energy dissipation luminosities uniformly distributed through the planet, and then he computes the size. So for HD 29458b, for a q of a million, you get a luminosity inside the planet of 9 times 10 to the 25 ergs per second. And so if that's put into a model with no core, the radius of the planet comes out as 1.4 Jupiter radii. So the point here is that not that this has proved the tidal dissipation hypothesis, but that it's not unreasonable if the eccentricity is 0.03 for tidal dissipation to be explaining the large size of the planet, and hence allowing other hot Jupiters all through the universe to be much smaller, which then gives serious ramifications for transit surveys and things like that.
Why is the radius of the planet the same?
Oh, because one had 10 times more. One had 10 times more energy. Okay, it's harder to pump up. It's harder to pump up a model with a core. That's what his code finds. So he's putting 10 times more energy into this one than into this one. So the core makes a big difference. And that's interesting for down the line, right? Because the core has a big effect for hot, short period transiting planets where you can measure the radius, that's a very interesting way of getting at whether these planets have cores or not. So given that, that it's possible, then you can say, all right, we've got this kind of skimpy HD 29458 data set. What kind of planet can I hide in there and still have things be okay? All right, the planet that you can hide in it as of last year, and this has not changed very much at all, even with the past year's data, which I'm going to show in a second. This right here is these PowerPoint slides just degrade the resolution incredibly, but the point right here is this is a power spectrum of the residuals to the one planet fit. And this peak right here is at 84 days. This peak right here is at 365 days, which is, of course, due to the Earth's phasing of the velocities. And so what I did is just to make a nominal model, I assume that the planet has a period of something around 80 days, and feed that into the code and get a best fit. What I find is that I can consistently hide inside the radial velocities. I can hide an 84-day planet with a 0.4 eccentricity and a mass about a tenth of Jupiter. That planet hiding in there will interact over a long period of time, over a secular timescale of 20,000 years, will cause an eccentricity variation of the inner planet, which will average out at roughly 0.03. So again, there's a consistency argument that says, okay, if tidal heating is going on, I can keep it large, and I can hide a planet of that size in the radial velocity data set. Now, another thing I've noticed about PowerPoint is if you put yellow, you really can't see anything. So I said, just because it fits, it doesn't mean it's there. Okay, so this is just a plausibility argument. So I'm not trying to say, oh yeah, we've detected this planet at a period of 84 days. It's just saying that the tidal heating hypothesis is still in play with this data. So in last year, Jeff at Keck got 19 new radial velocities. What I did was I applied for lick time, and then I swapped that lick time to him to observe over the course of the year at Keck, and at the end of the day there was 19 new radial velocities. Now, it doesn't sound like very many, but it's important to remember that University of California sells Keck time to NSF for $103,000 a night. And you can obtain, you know, sort of on a time average, you can obtain about 120 radial velocities a night with the radial velocity programs. So they're about $1,000 each. So this is $19,000 worth of new radial velocities. And again, you can fit an eccentricity of 0.027 is the best fit that just sort of comes out of a Lundberg-Marquardt fit to the data. But as you can see, the E is equal to 0 fit looks, you know, just as good. I mean, the whole thing doesn't look very good because of this low resolution of the PowerPoint. But nevertheless, it hasn't obviously helped that much. So you need to keep that in mind. So the question is have we measured with this best fit of E is equal to 0.3? Does that mean anything at all? So the way to get at that is to do a Monte Carlo analysis. And so the way I've sort of motivated that is to, first of all, let's assume that the system is really in a circular orbit. I can compute, given the times that I know the star was observed, I can compute what the radial velocity of the star would have been. I have estimates for the stellar jitter. I have estimates for the internal radial velocity precision. And so I can make a synthetic data set, and I can fit to that data set and see what I get. And I can do that over and over and over again. And so when I fit to synthetic systems that have zero eccentricity, I get all these open symbols. And they are all over the map. Okay, they're ranging out to E of 0.04. And their average falls right here, and their variance is right here, even though the true eccentricity of the Monte Carlo system is actually zero. And another interesting effect that's going on is for the systems that fell in the between 270 and 360 degrees, or 180 and 360 degrees, I've just folded them onto this side. And you can see that for the zero eccentricity systems, they prefer an argument of perihelion of 90 degrees and actually 270 degrees, which has been folded down to 90 degrees. And that's because it's easier to build up a variance in a distribution than a skew. And when you have an argument of perihelion or periastron of 90 degrees, then you have a symmetry on both sides of the radial velocity curve. And so scatter makes it easier to get a finite eccentricity for a zero eccentricity system, a finite measured eccentricity for these arguments of perihelion near 90. Now, it's worrisome that when you fit to the actual data, you find an argument of perihelion of 95 degrees. And I do the same Monte Carlo analysis on this best fit. I assume that that's really there. I make Monte Carlo estimates or new Monte Carlo data sets. I fit and I find this variance on the fits around the known eccentricity. And so the fact that these two boxes overlap almost completely means that with the current radial velocity data set, there's no information about whether the eccentricity is 0 or 0.03. We just don't know, unfortunately, yet. Now, the mean velocity is in the simulations, the mean velocity is fixed at 0, but I have offset as a free parameter. So even though I know that the mean velocity is 0, I know what the mean velocity is, I grab my distributions around that mean velocity, but I allow the fits don't know about it. They have to find that. So it's a free parameter just as in the real data set. So I'm not removing that from my four parameters that I have to fit to. Yeah?
Is there an estimate of the session period for an orbit over the center?
There is. It's pretty slow, I believe. I can look this up. I don't remember the number off the tip of my head. But I don't think it's observable on this time scale at all. So what you can say is, all right, we know we don't have the eccentricity yet. What is it going to take to get that? So a naive thing to do is to, all right, we're going to hit it really hard 3 nights in a row. So this is a Monte Carlo simulation that hits the system 3 nights hard in a row. It turns out that gives you literally nothing because the fits just sort of pull apart where there's no data and they pull together where there is data. That is extraordinarily unhelpful. So what you need to do is you need to get full phase coverage of the system. And so what I have is a subroutine called KECTAC, which I've looked at all of Jeff's observing runs for the past 5 or 6 years and look and see how the runs are given to him. He gets a lot of engineering nights. He, of course, only gets bright time. There's various subtleties in how his time is distributed. And so I have a subroutine that assigns him observing runs. And then when 209458 is within 2 hours of the meridian, to either side, then I schedule observations. And so I spread observations of 29458 through an entire year of a typical Keck nights that are given to the UC radial velocity program. That allows construction of new data sets.
So, find it out in your simulation?
Yeah, because he can get 200 velocities per night, and I ask for 120 radial velocities. So what I'm doing is I'm getting a total of one night time if the Keck tat gives it to me, and I'm saying, okay, instead of asking for 200 velocities, I'm statistically going to ask for 120 velocities from that night of time. So that takes into effect the effect of clouds. So this is the result. These black symbols are the green symbols are the ones that you've already seen. Those are the Monte Carlo fits that I just talked about with the current set of data. The black boxes, the black circles here, the open black circles here, are the results that I get from 120 new epochs sampled from this Keck-Tech subroutine, and assuming either a system which has an eccentricity of 0.027 or a system that has an eccentricity of zero. And so as you can see, with, and also in this case, I assume a stellar jitter of 6 meters per second, which is what I'm, this assumes that all of the excess scatter is due to stellar jitter from the fit. And so this is a somewhat conservative estimate of stellar jitter. And it still becomes very hard to say anything about the eccentricity. This box and this box are sort of different by only one sigma. You can make another assumption. Instead of 6 meters per second jitter, you can assume 4 meters per second jitter in the star in addition to the radial velocity errors that they get from the velocity determination method. In that case, the two eccentricities are starting to separate out by a little more. But it's still a very tough detection to make with one night of Keck time. Okay, so that's it for HD 29458, which is most of the talk. The point is that the eccentricity is an extremely interesting quantity to measure, but it's going to be tough to measure. It's going to take several equivalent nights of Keck time to get at that. This right here is a picture of where the GG876 planets have been since the observation of the star was begun back in the late 80s. GG876 is an M-dwarf star of about 0.3 solar masses that's accompanied by two planets which are in a 2-to-1 mean motion resonance. This right here is the best coplanar edge-on fit to the system. It shows that the periapses of the two planets are aligned quite well. They're quite deeply in the resonance. And the system as a whole, these periapse lines, are precessing backwards at a rate of minus 40 degrees per year. So the system is actually precessed around several times since the beginning of the radial velocity observations. To fit this system, to fit GG876, you have to do three-body fits rather than Keplerian fitting. When you do a three-body fit, you get a nice overall fit to both the Lick and the Keck velocities that have come out. And so because the fact that you get a much better fit from three-body fits rather than Keplerian fits, and three-body fits are dependent on the actual inclinations of the systems, it's interesting to ask, you know, what can you get from the self-consistent fitting? The GG876 system is very interesting because the libration of the planet's periapses around alignment and the libration of the 2-to-1 resonant arguments tell you about how the system was put together. And Willie Clay, Manhoi Lee, and Richard Nelson all talked about simulations that are looking at the GG876 system in their talks. And so it's important to see what the radial velocities can tell us about the system. Another kind of interesting thing for this system is that if there's mutual inclination between the two planets, any significant mutual inclination, then the precession can cause one or both of the planets to precess into transit. It's a little bit like our varying view of Pluto-Charon system allowed an epoch during the 1980s when transits were observable. The same kind of thing can happen with GG876. The GG876 transit will be about at the depth of about 10%. You could see it with binoculars if you knew what you were doing. So there's many interesting things that kind of come out of the GG876 radial velocities. So the question is can you determine the inclination of the system, either coplanar inclination or mutual inclination? And unfortunately, my argument is that you can't. So what I've done here is I have assumed, first of all, this red curve takes the GJ76 data, and I assume various coplanar inclinations to the line of sight from edge on out to very highly inclined to the line of sight, and I compute the chi-squared of the fit as I vary these inclinations. And what you see when you do this is you see a very shallow minimum out here, in this case near 35 degrees, and then another minimum out near 50 degrees. And the question is can you believe that at all? It turns out that the answer is that you can't. If I take this best fit edge-on system and then create Monte Carlo realizations of it, all of which I know have zero coplanar inclination, then the runs of chi-squared, as I do this exercise again and again, all show similar behavior to the actual fits to the actual data. And so these sorts of dips that you see, minima and chi-squared, at a particular coplanar inclination to the line of sight, these can't be believed. So we know this right here is telling us real information. The fact that the chi-squared gets worse and worse and worse and ramps up beyond 50 degrees inclination to the line of sight, but for systems that are within 40 or 50 degrees of being edge on, we can't distinguish at this point between those. Another interesting thing is that you can ask, as I do those exercises, how do the libration widths for the resonances change? So here is, again, the real fit to the data. This is the libration width of the 2-to-1 resonant variables averaged together. This goes down to very low values for inclination angles of roughly 40 degrees, and then only starts to come up slowly as you go to very high inclinations. And so originally I was excited because the fact that this seemed to get very low, actually literally to zero, for a value that corresponded to the perceived minimum in the chi-square, I thought, oh, that's dynamical information that the system is telling us. It's got to be right. It's damped all the way down. But Monte Carlo fits to a system that has this known property right here show this same kind of behavior. And the same thing happens for the apsidal resonance as well. The fit to the data looks like this. These Monte Carlo realizations of a system that is known to be coplanar and edge-on also show this same run of behavior. So the GJ76 system, while very interesting and you must use three-body fits to get at it, you can't get as much information as that I, for one, had been thinking when we first started working on that. Now I'd like to finish up here with kind of an exciting this just in sort of result. HJ80606 was announced a few years ago as a planet having an extraordinarily high eccentricity. I know that several people in this room have written papers trying to understand why the eccentricity of this planet is so high. I think the measured value that was published by the Swiss was an eccentricity of 0.925, something of that order, extremely highly eccentric. The system is in a wide binary with a sort of projected separation of 1,200 AU roughly, and a period of 111 days, and the radial velocity showed this, you know, signature of a very high eccentricity. Once the planet was announced in 2001, the California group started picking it up and got additional velocities. And what's interesting is one of the Keck velocities that was caught during the time when the planet is going near periastron is way up here, and is significantly higher than these. You have an overall latitude for shifting the Keck velocities up and down relative to the Swiss velocities, but there's enough Keck velocity so that that latitude is pretty constrained, and so this point really does seem to be quite high. The scale here is getting towards a kilometer per second, so the 3 to 5 per second error bars are tiny on this scale. So this point right here has the effect of increasing the swing, which has the effect of increasing the eccentricity. This is what the orbit looks like for that fit. 0.9718, 111-day period, this thing comes swinging in to within 2 or 3 stellar radii, and there's a tremendous amount of action during the periastron passage. Right now, this is 318, so 320, 319. So right now, just during this talk, the planet has moved from here to here within this fit. And then in the next couple days, on the equinox, this thing is going to go swinging around. In one day, it goes from here to here. Then the next day, on March 22nd, there's a 9-hour transit window. The transit probability for this thing is 6%. So it's a very, very exciting system. Interestingly, Greg Henry, who does photometric follow-up for us, can't observe this system because the separation between the two binary components is exactly on the edge of his aperture. So he'll have the other star sort of vibrating in and out, and that will ruin his photometry. But if you don't have that particular setup, there's a good chance, well, not a good chance, but a 5% chance that you could be a hero by observing a deep photometric transit for this system, which would be a big deal. So I don't really know what's going on. One thing that I've been thinking about the past couple days for explaining that this is the last transparency, explaining this system, is to look at these configurations where you have a one-to-one type resonance. A one-to-one resonance can bring the eccentricity down a little bit while retaining the period, and can also provide a method, perhaps, for keeping the tidal heating from damping this planet down on the timescale that the star has been around. So I'll stop there and open it up for questions. Yeah, Hal?
Didn't Matt do a paper on this using the cosine with the other star?
Yeah, Matt did a paper on this, and then Norm did a paper on this with
so why can't the cosine just be responsible?
But I think for 0.978, you get problems with. Does that work? 0.978?
Still work.
Okay.
But it ought to be tidally evolving, obviously. But when you go through the cosine resonance again, it's going to pull off. So it'll live a long time, even though it's tidally evolving right now.
This is
double
star system?
It's a binary star system, yeah. And it's got this planet down in there.
1,200 AU projected.
No, for this system.
He did it
for this system. Yeah, and you can drive it to high enough eccentricities, and then you have to worry about both the tidal and the GR effects down in the center, which sort of stop it. Of this planet, of the star. What about rotation of the star? Yeah. The GR is more important. And then the question, of course, is, you know, if it's that close, you would think it would tidally evolve in, but the cosi will again pull the periaps back up, which will allow it to live for a reasonably long time, actually.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a shot in the dark, although this is observable on a...
So will it stop at 0.97?
What did it stop at when you were...
At 0.97, if the eccentricity is indeed 0.97, unlike the Swiss team's report 0.93.
Right. Now, the only reason why it's come up is, I mean, you can see that it's this point right here has driven the eccentricity up. So it's resting on one point, but the error bar is microscopic on the size scale of this plot. So the Swiss never observed the planet during this crazy swing, right? And so they didn't sample the full extent of the radial velocity excursion. But they've got you know, the other instruments are set up at Keck.
Right, it's uncomfortable because the GR precession, the periaps for this kind of orbit will be way larger than the precession caused by the companion. But okay, if you're confident of the orbit, we have to make another theory.
The orbit rests. I wouldn't go and do a bunch of work on this right now. The orbit rests on this point right here. It rests on that point. If you take away that point, then the eccentricity can be brought right down.
But there's nothing wrong with that point.
There's nothing wrong with that point.
I'm even more worried about the internals function.
Yeah, it's very worrisome, right? I mean, it's an interesting, but so I'm throwing that out, but I don't. You know, I mean, it needs a tremendous use of a Keck night would be to get it right during that periap swing. I mean, that'd be great. No, not on March 21st. Someone else wants to give up their time and then, you know, put the high res spectrograph on Keck and do it.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
I have a question back here. What about the heating during this transit, the tidal heating due to flexing of the planet? We've heard that this is important for your other much more docile planet. Would not that destroy this planet on times much shorter than 2.5 billion years?
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to understand that eccentricity, but it's also hard to understand how it's not there if that rate of velocity is correct.
So I'm still confused after the exchange between Norm and Yan Chin. If you just do point mass dynamics, forget about tidal heating, is the GR precession at this pericenter distance such that the Kozai type perturbations are wiped out?
Close to 0.97, I should say. It's going to be very marginal. Yeah, it's hard to see how you can actually push it right up.
Okay, so then point mass type secular perturbations do not work, could not explain this high in eccentricity. That's the conclusion now?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, Kozai has stopped a long time ago. He's just studying something about it now. Except, if you do that, you keep the periapsis.
You mean Kozai brought it in and then thought that Kozai at very high altitudes?
Right.
Even
if it's small
enough. Well, close to tidal
dissipation. It's true. It's true. But if it's really that close,
pick up.
Sorry, there's a lot of discussion over at this end. So the difficulty is when the periapsis is that close, you don't have to worry about the long-term evolution at all. It's just every time you go by, you're going to dump so much heat into the planet that it's not clear what it'll do, but it's not going to sit there as a nice planet anymore. It'll be very bad for it. So, but on the other hand, as Greg says, I mean, there's the data point. So maybe the interpretation has got a little bit of slop in it. If you just, you know, the tidal force goes like a large power of the periaps, so if you just make the periaps another factor two bigger, then it's not so worrisome.
Two brief questions. The first for Greg. I see that the amplitude uncertainty is small in terms of the error of 3 meters per second. However, you only have one point up there, and it's not at the very peak of that curve. If you're a little bit off on the phase.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I need to do a Monte Carlo. Just like, anyway, I spent a lot of time talking about GJ76 and H229558 and doing a Monte Carlo here, and then I've not done one here, just throwing this out. So that what you're saying is absolutely right, and so I need to see what the error bars are on these orbital elements.
Well, let's say that it was a precise point in that the radial velocity was right, but it was at the maximum radial velocity. What eccentricity would you get?
Oh, I don't know. It would be higher than 0.9. It would be higher than 0.92. It would not be as high as 0.97.
Okay. And for Norm, you say that it could go in and out of this and last for 5 billion years, but it wouldn't be in this cycle phase of the oscillation very often. So our chances of seeing it would be small. So can you quantify that?
Well, you can't go in and out if it comes this close.
No, I'm just saying in the past, it would have been going in and out of this tidal evolution phase. Now, the orbit's small enough. So the idea was that the orbit was originally bigger, say major axis was bigger, and you know, say roughly circular. Then we went through the first Kozai phase, the periaps came in close to the star, you dissipated a bit of energy and the orbit shrank a little bit. Then it lifted back off again. So you went through several Kozai resonances like that and the orbit kept shrinking. And then fairly recently, it actually got small enough that you could no longer use the Kozai to pull the periaps up.
But fairly recently, in terms of a reasonable tidal dam, what are the chances of us seeing this very long in orbit?
In this phase, it's actually not so crazy, I forget. Lasts of order a billion years, or no. But I'm saying this phase to shrink it down to a small eccentricity. Yeah, it's something like a giga year.
This is about eccentricities. There's this theory that you discuss and others discuss, where if you have small enough separation, it becomes circular, right? And so people usually plot eccentricity versus period, and then below roughly 10 days, they all look circular. But how circular are those orbits, really? I mean...
Well, that's exactly what is going
no,
on.
No, I mean, forget this planet stuff. I'm asking a stellar question because, you know, it's easier to measure there. I mean, when someone looks at a stellar binary, what is the best circular measured, let's say, of a five-day stellar binary? So what I'm trying to hint at, you know, because all this RV stuff, I could have told you the answer before you did your simulations. This data are never that precise to do anything like this. Okay.
Wait, the data are not precise to do anything?
This 3 meters per second is not good enough for these sorts of dynamical tests. I mean, you know...
Well, I would disagree with that.
Okay. I mean, that's why you can't in the other system, unlike 1257 plus 12, you can solve for and look for perturbations and so on. So I'm saying at this current...
But wait a second. In GJ76, you are seeing perturbations.
Oh, yeah, but you're not getting the coplanarity and so on. It'll be a long time to get this sort of precision. Anyway, let me get off to the main question, which is, how precise are these orbits known to be circular? Could there be some residual eccentricity that... current observation.
So in a stellar binary.
If right now I'm treating it as a dynamical problem, not worried about the other guy as a companion or a star.
Well, I don't know because, I mean, I don't know what the radial velocity precision that you can do in a double line spectroscopic binary is. That's a different, it's not something that would have come out of this program because you have the problem with the two lines going back and forth, so your cross correlation wouldn't work. But what you do have is you have extremely high velocities, and so you should, I think with the proper analysis, you should be able to do at least as well as you do for HD29458, probably quite a bit better.
Right. My question, what I was trying to imply is that if we don't know that E should be zero, the theory tells you it should become exponentially zero. But let's say that's something we've forgotten, and these residual eccentricities are 1 or 2%. Are these ruled out by observation? That's the question I'm asking. So that's the question I'm raising is that, you know, at the level of 2%, with the kind of precision that is generally available, the best test would be for stellar binaries. And then so I'm asking someone who might know the answer to that, because you can't use this particular binary to put limits on eccentricity, you know, how orbital circularization. This is, the data are not good enough.
But 3 nights of Keck time would do it. 3 nights of Keck time would do it.
I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind is what you're actually measuring. And a lot of times there's kind of these fits that mysteriously give us best fit values and things. And for example, when you look at this figure, you know, the key thing to kind of look at is not so much where the top point is, but kind of the span from the top point to the bottom point. And so equally important for getting this thing's pericenter very precisely is getting the points near the bottom as well as the ones near the top.
Yeah, I am. Jeff, I think that, I mean, they had problems with snow on Keck in the past couple weeks, but Jeff got a couple points last week, I believe, when he was on.
Okay, but so I guess
it was coming towards the bottom last week, so that will help.
Yeah, so I guess my point was that, you know, like Shri was asking, you know, can we really measure these eccentricities even in stellar systems? And, you know, things like an eccentricity is basically a shape parameter, which is very difficult to measure for small eccentricities. Whereas in these multiple planet systems where you have strong interactions, you know, for example, the main thing you see is the precession frequency. And so just in general, it's worth really thinking about what do I actually measure, as opposed to I've translated this to a best fit and then kind of go do a bunch of theory on some best fit number rather than thinking what's actually measured in an observational sense.
Probably the last question.
I'll make it quick. Is it possible to measure, to get a dynamical estimate of the mass of the star for this system?
Over this system?
Yes.
And how would you do, I mean,
well, if you can measure the relativistic precession of the...
Yeah, in that case, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's going to be tough to see relativistic precession on several year time scale. I think that that's a bit much. So I mean, relativistic precession is keeping things from happening on a secular time scale with regards to pumping up the electricity, but I think it's going to be hopeless to observe that on a baseline of a few years.
Okay, let's move on to the next talk.